Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to Raising a Pro. I'm Annie Apple, journalist and NFL mom to my son, Eli Apple. Today's guest is one of the busiest women I know. Jemele Hill is joining us and kicking off our Black History Month appreciation and coverage. Remember guys, Black history is American history. And these conversations may get a little raw, but history, when it's told in its truth, is raw, it's uncomfortable, and it's sensitive. But you'll be all right. You know her from her former job at ESPN. She's also co-host of Won't Stick to Sports on Vice TV. She's a contributing writer for The Atlantic and has a very successful podcast, Jemele Hill is Unbothered. Along with creating a TV empire, I'm telling you, she is blessed, booked, and busy. And we're glad she took time to talk to us today. Today, we get to hear from the 2018 National Association of Black Journalists Journalist of the Year, Jemele Hill, who eloquently reminded the world that Donald Trump wasn't shit. I'm sorry, that Donald Trump was a white supremacist, and she was, guess what, proven right. But before this truthsayer burst onto the scene, she was a little determined black girl from Detroit. You have shared some of your growing pains in, like, your parents' battle addiction. So how was it you were able to dream of having a career, a dream of having a life that you really normally didn't see around you?
Well, thank you, Annie, for having me on. I really appreciate being here. And considering who your guest usually is, I mean, you're talking to mothers of very successful and accomplished athletes. And here I am, woe is me, being a high school softball legend.
Let them know. Flex on them hoes.
In my own mind.
Flex on them hoes.
Right, exactly. I was like, in my own mind, though, mostly. So it feels good to have been put in this very select company of being a guest on your podcast. But to answer your question, people, you know, of course, I can't account for everybody's, you know, faith or whatever, but it had to be a divine plan because I don't know where I got it from or why I had it. This came from nowhere but God, because there was no reason why a little old black girl and growing up in inner city Detroit would ever have thought to be a sports writer. It doesn't make any sense. Now, granted, I read the newspaper religiously because kids, you had to do that back in those days to keep up with your sports teams. And I read the sports sections, you know, just whenever I could get my hands on the paper. My grandmother, she did crossword puzzles. So she got the paper almost every day, right? Because crosswords were her things. And I would just sneak out that little sports section. And my mother was a domestic worker for a while. And one of her clients, an old white dude named Mr. Miller, he got both subscriptions to both newspapers every day. And so whenever I would go with her, when she cleaned his house, then I would just kind of take a sneak peek at the newspaper and look at the sports section, because I was a really big baseball fan. I was a Tigers fan, and I loved sports. I'm not really sure where that came from either. It's just something that I just naturally always gravitated to. I love to play sports. I was a neighborhood tomboy. So loving to read and loving sports, at some point it became clear to me that I could combine these two things. And so I took a high school journalism class at Mumford, and it changed my life. And I was able to start a relationship with the professional paper, the Detroit Free Press, in high school. They had an apprenticeship program that I was accepted into when I was in 11th grade. And so I spent 6 weeks at the newspaper learning about being a journalist, learning how newspapers worked. And it was a convergence of divine events, because not only was I accepted into this program that was for Metro Detroit area high school students, but it was the same summer that NABJ, the National Association of Black Journalists, held their annual convention, and it was in Detroit. And so the director of the apprenticeship program, she marched us down to Cobo Hall in downtown Detroit and made us sign up for a membership to NABJ and made us go around, yeah, and talk to people. and we had to have resumes and we had to dress in our little business outfits or whatever we had that would count for a business outfit and introduce ourselves to people and tell them we wanted to be a journalist and show them, you know, our writing samples because we were writing during this apprenticeship. And so it was all at the time very humiliating, or not necessarily humiliating. It was just your kid, you're shy. So like walking up to random people, very different.
Yeah,
but she
different.
Made us do it. And she was just like, you have to be on the grind. You have to really be somebody who's very vigilant about this career because you need internships and you need experience. And that's how it works. So she drilled a lot of lessons into our heads. So, you know, I guess it was just one of those things that a seed was planted in me, and it was planted and buried so deep that it was in my spirit and in my soul. And so ever since then, I have done everything possible to, you know, to try to adhere to that. You know, this is the only thing I've ever done and the only thing I'm good at, because I suck at math. Trust me. You don't want me working at a cash register. You don't want me doing your taxes, you know.
Well, let's go back, though, because both of our, I didn't know your mom was a domestic worker, because my mom, when we came from West Africa, my mom also, like, worked in the homes of, like, you know, rich or well-off white people, took care of an elderly one. And so we got, I don't know if your mom told you some stories, but I know my mom used to come home, and there was one white lady she used to work for, older lady. The lady couldn't do anything for herself, you know, so my mom did everything for her. But the lady always had this mentality that we were still back in those days where black folks weren't free. So my mom would be like, hey, I'm going to the store. So she would literally be like, you niggers are allowed to go out by yourself. Wait, let me come with you. Like, she didn't, like, she would say that.
So somebody had given her, like, the update.
Yeah. And, you know, like, I don't know how when they get older, the brain goes back to wherever it was. So my mom's like, no, we were free. You know, like, we can go out now. And at times she would be really, really rude. And I think my mom said she had to sit her down one day and said that, you know, you have all this money, but your money doesn't get up and make you something to eat. Your money doesn't bathe you. Your money doesn't do all that people do. So you have to learn how to be nice to people. So I remember watching my mom, you know, she had like 3 jobs to be able to take care of her family, do all of this, but still maintain like her integrity. You know what I mean? Like, she just still, that was the job that she had to do to take care of her family. She was an evangelist that had traveled around the world. But when you come to America, you know, you do the job that's available to you. So I just remember her coming back home and sharing that story, which as an immigrant kid, it kind of made you even want to work even harder. So you were able to provide not just for yourself, but for your family.
Well, I think there's a lot to that. My parents, one of the biggest lessons that they were able to pass down to me when I was growing up was teaching me, often without knowing it, everything not to do. And so so I looked at some of the choices they made and some of the circumstances they were left to deal with. And I did not want that for myself. And my mother, though, she never told me stories like that. And it just so happened that this elderly white guy, he was not like that. He, far as I could tell, was not racist. And so,
oh, my mom has some characters.
Yeah. And I'm sure my mother probably does have some other stories that maybe she hasn't shared, because she, you know, she cleaned houses. And when we briefly lived in Houston, Texas, she actually owned her own cleaning company. And so I'm sure she has some stories from that, too, that we've never really tapped into, that she's never shared. But one of these days I'm gonna have to ask her like what kind of characters did she meet along the way. But I mean, it wasn't just about the, you know, seeing the domestic work that said, oh yeah, I don't want to do that. I just wanted a life with, you know, options and choices. I wanted to get out of Detroit. You know, I've always had like a wanderer spirit. So I was very curious about other parts of the country and the world. And so the best way I could think of to do that, and regardless of the struggles that my mother went through with her addiction, I mean, she was always very serious about education. And my grandmother was very serious about education. So this idea that I wasn't allowed to achieve because she was struggling in her own life was never one that was acceptable in my house. And so, you know, her favorite phrase used to be drunk, drugged, or indifferent, meaning regardless of these 3 things of what I am, you still need to do what you need to do.
You got to be better.
So yeah. I, because of that, I never was able to use that or lean on that excuse of what she was going through, as painful as it was to have to witness it. I was never able to use it as an excuse not to achieve.
You know, and that's the discussion we're going to get into later, talking about some of the things that we learned growing up that we have to unlearn as adults, right? But then you went to Michigan State. My apologies about that.
We on the same team, man. We both hate Michigan.
So you went to Michigan State, and I want to talk a little bit about college football because you did cover the sport out there during the pandemic. You know, there was this struggle in the beginning. Should they play? Should they not play? They ended up playing. What are your thoughts on, you know, college athletes playing during a pandemic?
So this is a nuanced issue, and people have to understand that this is what I want people to keep in mind before they judge or assess what I'm about to say. I make my living through sports. I always have. The more games that are played, the more money I make, all right? Or the more useful that I am in my profession. So it's an economy that has been able to provide me with a lifestyle. So I have a vested interest in seeing people play. That being said, they have no business playing. It's a travesty. It really is. Because I think when we look back on this year, why? I mean, we have over 100 games that have been canceled. I mean, they're trying to piece together these championships. They're trying to, every week, it's like 10, 12 games postponed, canceled, like all kind of shenanigans. I mean, you had the game, as you are very familiar with, Michigan and Ohio State, did not happen this year because they had, you know, Michigan had dozens of players who had tested positive for coronavirus. They had a complete outbreak that was going on. And we don't know enough about this virus to know what it does to people. And I know that documentary that we're going to all watch 10 years from now, maybe not even that long. And we're going to say, what the hell were we doing and thinking? Like, we know what it was. Just follow the money. Yeah. It's really simple. Nobody wanted to give back any money. Nobody wanted to miss games. And these colleges, these college presidents in particular, they have built entire economies off free labor. And they weren't going to miss out on the money. And they cannot convince me, no matter what they say, that that wasn't the reason that they decided to come back. And I feel bad for the kids, for the athletes, because they honestly, and I mean this respectfully, don't know any better. Like, I know what they want. A lot of them have professional futures. They're trying to provide for their families. They're trying to set up generational wealth for their families. Everybody is not a pro, that's for sure. And they just selfishly want to play because they've committed their whole life to this game. Playing college football means something. So I'm not dismissing that. I understand emotionally why for them it makes a lot of sense to play. But they don't know what they don't know. And it's like, you know, my grandmother used to say this all the time. Youth is wasted on the young. To some degree, they're naive about their exploitation. And they're naive about this virus, as we all are. I mean, unfortunately, what happened in college football is just a reflection of what happened in America. We can't do the simplest of things. We can't make the most basic sacrifices of, like, not watching a college football game. I mean, come on. In the specter of things we would have to sacrifice, that's not that much. Let's all just watch Grey's Anatomy. I mean, it's been on for 400 years. Like, let's just watch that, okay? Like, we could do this, right? But we will not make the most.
But you know what? When you say to people, you know, when we look at slavery, the degradation of it, along with that, slavery was also a socioeconomic system, right? We forget that it was a business. Yes. And that same business model exists in many platforms today. I think we miss that. You know, when we talk about the NFL, we talk about NCAA, people are like, oh, well, no, they're getting money. I was like, you're missing the point. The point is the system. How was the system set up? And slavery was a business model. Because if it didn't yield any profits, any benefits, any monetary, it wouldn't have lasted as long as it did, right? So I think that model is definitely applied. We look at college football in a sense of kids who are worth so much money, who bring so much value in television money, in merchandise, do not get 1 cent of all that they bring in. Auburn's coach, they're paying him $21 million buyout. This man's been paid $21 million
to go away,
not to coach.
To go away.
You know what I mean? But there's no money to set up coaches. You know, my son went to Ohio State, where Urban Meyer is. Urban Meyer has created for himself and his children and his grandchildren. They have generational wealth that they've been able to attain through my son, Dawn Elliott's son, everybody's son. But we have somehow, as fans, and somehow as a society, it's acceptable to us. I don't understand that. I don't understand that. Nobody's going crazy.
Oh, you understand. You understand.
It's crazy to me.
You understand what it is. It's like, look, I mean, bottom line is that if the free labor looked a little differently, then it wouldn't be free labor, you know? And so that's just what it is. And I'm aware that white kids also play football, but the reality is that this is a system that...
Over 80% of it.
Yeah, it's us. I mean, it is a system used to exploit and treat black bodies as disposable. And that's not to say that, you know, I don't enjoy football as much as the next person. I'll say this. I'll make a distinction. Even though I didn't love the NFL coming back on the NBA, at least they're professionals. At least they're getting paid. At least they have a union.
They have a union. Correct. There's accountability. Yes. There are checks and balances.
They can make that decision. But when it came to college athletes, the wrong people were making the decision and they were manipulating their emotions. Because, again, I get it, and I don't want to play college kids like they're stupid or college athletes, because they're not, clearly. We will never have any idea how many of them actually wanted to play versus how many of them didn't. But, you know, they're using this carrot and dangling it in front of them and saying, hey, if you do this, then this will lie ahead for you, or don't you want to play? And I think people are very ignorant and naive to the amount of pressure that is put on these kids to perform. I mean, we already see it with college basketball. Like, they can't even get their season started. They got 400 games already gone, right? Coach K is, and I know people are on him saying that the reason that he wanted to sort of reset the season was because he had suffered a couple losses, and if he was undefeated, he'd feel differently.
Maybe people always come back to that.
They want to go, what about this? I get it. I understand that. But that being said, there is something not morally or ethically right about, now that we're in the holiday season, that there would be some colleges that would actually keep the athletes on campus and have them by themselves just so they can play games. A lot of the reasons why we have these outbreaks on college campuses is because the NCAA, or college presidents, let me be very specific, they knew what it would look like if you brought only the athletes back to campus and not the students. It would look like what the system is, which is, you want the money, they got to perform. Right. And so you couldn't make it look like, oh, no, let's go with this sham of amateurism. So you bring back all the students and you have the athletes and you're shocked that there's outbreaks everywhere. Of course it is. Right. But this was all rooted in greed. So you get what you get. And the one thing that I hope comes out of all of this is that I hope that this system has been thoroughly exposed for the clown system that it is.
And for the excuse that they always said, I remember years ago where, you know, when I was fighting to get college athletes' parents' travel stipend to go to a playoff system that they created, 3 major games in 3 weeks, and how you gonna get there? And nobody cared, because coaches, their kids, their wives, girlfriends, concubines, everybody got on a plane and flew for free. But poor college football parents had to go without paying their rent or their electric bill so they can be there to support their kids. I think we've gotten so used to taking morality and ethics out of sports, because it's easier to objectify, you know, the player.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we don't see him as, that's somebody's son. Maybe he should be home for Christmas during a pandemic and not sitting here, you know, by himself to entertain us. And I think the biggest fear they used to say was that, oh, if you pay the players, then all the other sports would disappear. All the other sports are disappearing and coaches are still getting paid. They cancel track, basketball, women, like all this.
That's a problem in itself, right? Because if we want to, like, really go next level deep, let's just talk about how really black players, as in the football and basketball players, are being used to funnel white sports and to subsidize white athletes. We can talk about that. I mean, they don't want to jump into that. Like, that's what's happening. And as you said, they're still canceling those programs anyway. So it doesn't matter.
And coaches are still getting $21 million buyout.
Yeah, they are. Well, it's so funny, though. What's so funny to me is that suddenly people want everything in college to be fair, right? When it never has been. We know there's a difference between what Ball State's weight room looks like in Alabama. We're perfectly okay with that, right? We're fine with that. But the moment you start talking about creating a system of checks and balances for football, then it's like, oh no, but we got to be equal. Everybody has to be making the same. So how would you pay them? It's not equal now. All right, go to Western Michigan's locker room. It don't look like Clemson's. They got a $60 million locker room. So it's already there. There's going to be different tiers. That's the way that it works. But that's a lazy excuse not to figure out a way to compensate the players that have generated a billion-dollar economy. And what's further exposed is that many of these colleges have become so financially dependent on football that they were forced to, and I don't want to say forced, like they didn't have a choice because they had a choice, but they have been forced to continue this cash cow of football. Like the Ivy League could cancel their league because they're not as dependent on football. So like they didn't play this season, right? But other sports are. And it's funny because like the HBCUs elected not to play and they're not nearly in a financial position as some of these Power Five schools are, but they certainly understood that, no, we don't need to play. I mean, granted, they have a lot of other financial issues, but the athletics part of it is just not as worth it to them as it is in some other schools.
And I think also for Power Five schools and other schools, the spending is crazy because I think
out of control
with the way their fiscal year, like I remember Ohio State one year, I think after the boys won the national title, they literally bought a fountain in the weight room, a water fountain, a wall water fountain that costs, I don't know how much money. I'm just saying the way they spend money. I remember years ago when I worked for NBC News and Tom Brokaw used to, you know, do this segment called The Fleecing of America, where it was just like, just spend the government money because nobody's checking. You know, you can say, I need a chair for this thing and it costs $2 million and the government write the check because nobody was really checking and balancing it out. And I feel like it's the same thing for college football because how is it that you're crying broke? You just had a $1 billion program, but because why? The way they spend the money, the bonuses the coaches get, the things they buy, like they're like, oh, we updated our facility. Who needs, why do the kids, I remember Texas, why do the kids need a television in their locker? Their parents can't even afford to pay their electric bill.
Oh, or the, you know, at Alabama, they got barbers. They got barbers that come in and it's like, they have all, and I realize these programs are the upper level, right? And once you get down further, the other schools, they can't all afford this. But I guarantee you at every program, it's wasteful spending. Like when I was a beat writer covering college football, I would always FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, for those who aren't familiar, everything at a university is public, all the records, everything. So as a reporter, you can go into their Freedom of Information Act office, because most of them have them on campus, and you could get a coach's full contract. You can get the contracts of everybody at the university, and you can look at their expenditures. A bowl trip where you might have just won 6 games, right? They are getting a charter plane. They're taking like 200 people, mm-hmm. like friends, family, mm-hmm. you know, neighbors, like you said, concubines. Everybody's going for free.
Everybody's okay? going.
Right? This is a necessary expense, okay? And it's like on a bowl trip where they may only be getting like $500,000. They spend it like $499. And it's just like, how is this yes. possible? Or why? You know?
And all that planning. And this one thing that blew my mind in 2014. They created this college football system. I said, they sat down in the room. Condi Rice too. They all sat down in this room. They created a system and nobody thought, well, how will the players' families get there? How is that? Nobody thought about that. I couldn't for the life of me wrap my head around that. I was like, no, this is what we're not going to do.
Yeah, well, they should be thinking that anyway for like even just road games for the season. It's just like, it's an expensive
child.
Yeah, I mean, and you're especially like the Big Ten, like you're talking to some out of reach places. Like people be shocked yes. what a plane ticket to State College costs. Like they'd be shocked because it's in the middle of nowhere.
And it was crazy.
Yeah.
I remember doing that campaign on social media and I got called every name in the book. And I remember one time Urban called me. And now, you know, when your kid is in college, you don't really hear from your head coach. You hear from the position coach. But this, I get a call one day from Urban Myers. I'm like, you know, what do you need? You know what I mean? So he was just like, oh, I heard you're on social media, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we don't want to antagonize the NCAA. He went on this thing. And I let him talk. And then I had to check him.
Good.
And I said, Urban, I don't tell you how to coach. You don't tell me how to parent. Mm. And I had to literally go through my resume. I hate to do that to people. But I'm like, don't call my phone trying to play me like I'm one of your little players.
Right. Oh, you know, a black woman put little on it, it's serious.
And it really brings me to you because I think when you spoke out and you called Donald Trump what he eventually showed the world that he was, that was an act of courage, because in this business, you answer to so many people. You have to think about so many people. You got to think about your paycheck. You got to think of your boss. You know, even working in television news, there are so many people that every information filters through. So you are never really free to fully express the truth as you see it. So I think when you did that, you gave a lot of us our freedom papers. In a sense of, no, literally in a sense of, because it's hard to, when you're Black, to live and work in a white environment. You feel like every day you clock in, you got to become somebody else. But I think what you did was allow us, yeah, my job is important, but my purpose is even more important. So tell me, what was that? What made you say, you know what? I'm going to step out here and do this.
Well, like all great moments in history, mine started with a Twitter argument. So as much as I would love to say that I had perfectly crafted this moment and like, you know what, the people are going to hear from me about this. That's not kind of how it was. I got into a back and forth with a Twitter user who was trying to defend Donald Trump. And this is 2017. This is just a few weeks after Charlottesville, where I felt, if you had at that point, you know, he's elected in 2016, he has a pretty ugly racial history coming in. And if you at that point had been thinking, okay, maybe once he gets into office after all these rallies and he's saying all this stuff, all that'll calm down. He'll settle into the office. He'll act like he got a little bit more sense, and
he'll take his, you know, medication. We'll just kind of
right. We'll take things from there. That's not what happened. He just continued to amp up and to expose more of his racism and his allegiance to white supremacy. So Charlottesville happens, and he has the hardest time condemning white supremacists and neo-Nazis who took over Charlottesville. And, you know, a young woman lost her life, Heather Heyer, and he could not even bring himself to show the most base level of sympathy, empathy, of understanding about the type of racist emotions he had invoked in these people who looked at him, yeah, as their leader. And so, you know, I was never on the Donald Trump bandwagon, but for sure, I knew it was never going to happen after that. And so there was somebody in my mentions trying to defend him. And so I just kind of laid it out. And to this day, I joke with him. I blame Ta-Nehisi Coates, who had written a powerful essay in The Atlantic that was on newsstands that month, where the title of it was called America's First White President. And it's a brilliant article, or essay, I should say, laying out all these things about, you know, it's basically from this premise. For Barack Obama, the former president, to be elected, he had to be the top of his class. He had to be the best. He had to be exceptional.
A unicorn. He had to be a
Correct.
Unicorn.
No scandal. Loving family. all this, like, he had to check
Ivy League
every single
and
box.
His wife had to be Ivy League.
Thank you. She's a, you know, credential wise, she's the smartest first lady ever, right? He had to have everything crystal perfect. And then we elect Donald Trump. And it's like, what? Like, all he had to do was be rich and white. There was like, he never held a government office. He was never the top of his class. He was like, he had been.
He was never even block captain.
You know what I'm saying? It's like he'd been, he had had multiple bankruptcies. He was known as a crook. Like, everything. He didn't have to have any level of training to become president. And if that's not the greatest example of how whiteness works in this country, I don't know what it is, right? So that is Ta-Nehisi's complete thesis, and he just builds the case. And so I'm just revved up between Charlottesville, this article. And so I took, you know, what you should do, take all your emotions to Twitter. And so, you know, I just said what I said. And the thing is, I didn't even think what I said was controversial. I promise you, Annie, it's the most unoriginal thing I've ever said, because I thought it was so obvious. Because
I've seen some good stuff from
you. Know what I'm saying? Like, this is totally unoriginal. Like, I thought it was obvious. And then it was like, oh, y'all didn't know? Like, they treated it like it was breaking news. And I was like, how is this breaking news, right?
But you know what? Let's talk about that. Because in sports, and I can't even say there's difference between news, sports, and entertainment, because it's all so jumbled now. You know, as a journalism major, where we learn journalism ethics, journalism, you know, media law, the whole thing, I feel like all of that stuff just went through the window. But I thought that we were truth tellers. That's what we were there to really tell what we see.
Yeah.
It came to a point where it affected your job. I recently did a podcast with Amy Trask, the first female CEO in NFL history. And she was talking about how she always felt this safety, you know, that, you know, she was given the safety to be able to make mistakes, to be able to grow. And that's what she does. She tried to provide that safe space where you can make mistakes. So I was sharing with her that I never felt that one day in my professional career. From the moment I graduated college as a Black woman, I felt like everywhere I went, nobody was invested in my growth. It was almost like, we're waiting for you to make the first mistake so we can pounce on you and get you. You always felt like you weren't in a nurturing environment. You know what I mean? You felt, you were made to feel like you're here, be happy you're here, you know, kiss ass, or, you know, you're on eggshells all the time. And when I hear, you know, for us as journalists, especially Black women, you're never in a space where you're like, well, I can speak this truth and I know I'm going to be all right. It's like everything is life or death. Everything is like hit or miss.
Yeah. I mean, that's usually the way it works. The consequences for us will be more severe. The line will be harsher. The reaction will be unforgiving and relentless. I mean, that's the way it works for most of us, wherever, whatever industry we're in. But obviously, I'm in a very public one. So people get to see this in real time. The thing is, though, it also exposes what I always thought was kind of unrealistic. I understood it, but if we think about it, this isn't very unrealistic. The thing is that what I said, you know, because I have to correct people to this day, I never said that Donald Trump was a white supremacist on SportsCenter. I didn't say, welcome to SportsCenter, Donald Trump is a white supremacist. Like, that's not what happened. It's like, I said this on Twitter, on my own personal account that does not have ESPN anywhere in the title of my account. But, you know, it said at the time what I did for a living, obviously, in my profile. And the thing is that people now, they consider social media to be media. And it's like, no, those are not the same thing. It's like, social media is a social interaction space. Media is like what you consume in terms of TV and newspapers and that kind of stuff and magazines and digital outlets and whatever. That is a different space. But for the average consumer, it's all together. So they cannot separate your Twitter person from your, you know, you delivering the 6 o'clock news. And as a journalist, it's always, especially if you're a Black journalist, it's always put you in a very uncomfortable bind because you're still a citizen. And to act like journalists have this kind of superhuman ability to separate everything, like we can't be biased. It's just like objectivity in our profession is a lie. And you know this, like it's a complete lie.
No, I think when they say be objective, they say be white. That's one thing because it's like, I remember when I worked in a newsroom and I wanted to work on some stories. You know, I grew up in Philadelphia. I went to high school and college in Philadelphia. And I remember working at this news station in Philadelphia and I'm like wanting to cover a certain story. And I'm like, oh, well, we need somebody who can be objective. Because I live in the neighborhood, I can probably bring you more insights than the little white girl that you just picked from the suburbs who have no idea. But they felt like because you're Black, you can't be objective.
Yeah. I mean, that's the message we're all sent, is that we cannot bring our full Black selves to work. That just is not, we cannot do it. Or it's going to be a real challenging experience. And I think this is a real wake-up call for those who want to be awakened, I should say, you know, for white people to understand just how much of ourselves we have to compromise and to minimize
all the time
to fit into their system of doing things, their system of whiteness. And it's exhausting. And a lot of Black people are tired. This is why I think that exhaustion and frustration, the combination of it reached a real boiling point this year, because we're tired of teaching. We're tired of handholding. We're tired of coddling. We're tired of protecting their feelings. We're just like, we have spent our whole lives doing this. It's like, at some point we have to say, this is enough. And collectively, I think we all jointly kind of said that. That doesn't mean that we don't possess any empathy, but it does mean that the system of racism and oppression and white supremacy and white privilege has existed in the fabric of this country for so long. You saying that you didn't know, or, you know, acting as if these problems just showed up, is not only privilege in itself, but it's also unacceptable. Like, I'm not going to sit up here and teach you 400 years of history because your ass never decided to be curious about the other people living in this country. I'm just not doing it. And I wouldn't expect somebody else. I wouldn't expect an indigenous person to sit down and teach me about what happened to Native peoples. I wouldn't expect that. That's like ridiculous. But that's what the expectation of us is. It's like, okay, white people. So then when in 1619, let me tell you what happened. It's just like, no, I'm not doing that. Pick up a book.
And I think it also the burden that falls on us, because it's like, oh, they're racist because they don't know they're being racist. You do know.
They absolutely know.
I'm sorry, you do know. It's just like you know when you're being an asshole. Like, you do know.
You do know.
It's not lost on you. And, you know, we both read Isabel Wilkerson's book, Caste. And one thing that I know I got out of it, and it was, I definitely recommend that book. It's the most historically, currently accurate book you can read when you want to understand how our system worked. You know what I mean? It was almost like, let me give you the blueprint. Let me give you the recipe. You know what I mean? It's cooked differently or whatever, but this is what it is. And one thing I gathered from it was like, a caste system really puts everybody in a certain kind of part. They give you a part to play. They give you a role, but it's up to you. One thing I say to myself, well, it's up to me now to decide what role I'm going to play and what role I'm not going to play in this system. Because when you step back, you see it and you see how you're manipulated. You see how things are set up. Now that you have that wisdom, how are you going to play a different role? Which really gets me to the next point I want to kind of jump on, is that what is it as African Americans, what is it about us? What training we have that we need to unlearn? Because we talked earlier about slavery being a socioeconomic system, and let's focus on the sociology of it, because you have this whole plantation living, right? So you have your oppressors. You learn your value, you learn your stand, all these things, how you relate to each other is based on the pressure that you are under and how you're oppressed. And I think there are some of it that we have gathered and we carried on with us, right? So I like to look at some of the things that we have adopted into, whether it's raising family, whether it's interacting with one another, or even how we relate to one another, that we need to unlearn. What are some of those things that come to mind?
Well, one thing that it's uncomfortable for us to acknowledge or even think about is that we learned a lot of anti-Blackness in our own households, right? And because there was always, as you said, we're looking at the oppressor. We're looking at the standard of whiteness has been a standard that we've all accepted. It is the standard. And we judge ourselves and each other accordingly. And so a lot of these anti-Black habits that we have, anti-Blackness that we have toward one another, was developed based off a system of whiteness that we also were complicit and bought into. And by complicit, I don't mean that we obviously weren't in control of these systems, but we participated in it nonetheless, is that Black folks can judge each other just as harshly as white folks. And that's why I love about Isabel Wilkerson's book, is that by thinking of ourselves on a caste system, we understand, you know, the conversation about criminal justice, very needed, long overdue. But when we think about people who are incarcerated in our own community, in our own families, we treat them the same way that greater society does, by expecting the worst of them, by not wanting to give them a chance because we can't trust them. Like, Black people, ain't nobody harder on Black people than other Black people, or harder than. We are hard on each other. Like, I think about the conversations that we often have about Black businesses, right? There's this idea that Black people don't support Black business. And I'm like, I don't know who told this lie, but we go out of our way to support Black businesses, you know? Out of our way. But even when we do support them, we hold them to a level and a standard that we would never hold white businesses to. And it's just like, well, why are we doing this to each other? This doesn't make any sense. And even on the opposite side, as a Black business owner, there are things, you know, that story about True Kitchen that went viral, about the owner in Dallas who went off on everybody at brunch because some women were twerking. He didn't like it. There was a safety issue there. I got it. I understood. And it was more Black people than anything cheering him on. Like, that's right. You tell him. I wish There ain't a white general manager that would stand up in the middle of his restaurant and cuss and everybody cuss. Out. That would never happen. And
it would never happen.
That would never happen. Like the dude, like you
could never happen. And let me tell you something. When I was in college in Philadelphia, I went to school full time. I worked full time at a 5-star hotel. And where I saw white folks show all their asses. And nobody got cussed out.
Nobody. Much less the whole restaurant getting a lecture. It's like, dude, like, I get it. You're trying to preserve your business.
Like, he was like, stop the music. Right. Let me treat you like a 4-year-old.
Yeah, it was like, that would never happen. So that's an example of, like, this anti-blackness that we ourselves adopt, that we tend to think, because it's not put on blast the same way, we tend to think that our behavior is somehow singularly so much worse than everybody else's, or that there are certain values we don't have. I mean, especially you get around older black people, boy, they talk about young black people like they ain't nothing. I'm like, oh God, like, is that what you expect of them? So, you know, and if you don't know what I'm talking about, just go back and listen to Bill Cosby's pound cake speech. You'll understand. At any rate, so that's one thing we definitely need to unlearn. I think we also need to unlearn this kind of, we need to be able to affirm vulnerability in our community. And that is very hard for us to do. I get it. I mean, most of us were raised in a way that was to prepare us for this world. I mean, it's hard because, you know, as parents, y'all dealing with a lot. You have your own issues and you're trying to raise the best human being possible. But it's also with the idea in mind of, I need to treat you a certain way, or I need to be harsh with you in a certain way because the world is about to be harsh with you. And somebody on Twitter said something. It actually was quite smart. So I don't know who this person is, so I can't credit them properly. But they said that people that grew up in super strict households didn't learn to become better people. They learned to become better liars. And
yep, actors.
Yeah, they did. It's true. And because, you know, the way some of us have been raised is that, you know, we're not allowed to be vulnerable. We're not allowed to feel a certain way about anything. And while we may laugh at some of the universal parenting, black parenting in particular, that we grew up with, and a lot of it is funny. So I'm not here to denounce anybody's parenting, and certainly not to denounce my own mother for sure. But there were things that were passed down from her mother, from the mother beforehand, that were about building such a harsh culture of discipline that it didn't really teach us how to have certain relationships with our parents and with elders.
With what you just said, I always feel like as black people, I feel like we weren't raised. We were ruled. We just knew boundaries and limitations. We lived for permission, never freedom.
Ooh. You better speak that word, Miss Apple.
And that's what, when I was thinking about this, that's what I wrote down, because I was just like, that's growing up, because it was always like, don't do this because I said so. Well, I need to know a little bit more. You know what I mean? Right. It was never about, well, let me open it. And, you know, in defense of them, it was probably very much fear-based. Do you know what I mean? Because they were like, they knew the world you're going to have to, so you have to be harsh. But at least give me the opportunity to explore. Give me the information. Let me develop into that person. You know what I mean? That I feel like God has created me to be. So I thought about what we're going to talk about today, and I wrote down, I said, I feel like we weren't raised. We were ruled. We just knew boundaries and limitations. We lived for permission and never freedom. So we learned to, so that's why, you know, you can go over your cousin's house, somebody else, and act a whole fool, but you couldn't, you learn how to be actors, where it's just like, or you learn to just exist always in fear.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's so truthful because, you know, most of us kind of realize that there was a certain code that we always had to follow, and the rules didn't always make the most sense.
No,
they always didn't. And I know that spanking is a very polarizing issue in our community. Friends of mine who have kids now, I know some that do and some that don't. And it's interesting to talk to the ones that don't, because these were people who were raised, you know, being spanked and with the belt and all that. And it's no judgment if that's how you want to raise your children. However, the thing that was very striking to me about why they stopped is because they didn't want their children to fear them. That was one of the things. And you brought up that fear the fear-based parenting that I think a lot of Black parents kind of go by, because they feel like we got to be very harsh to make sure that you don't step outside these particular boundaries, because in society, when you do, there's a consequence that's far harsher than anything I could come up with if you do that. But it's just what they're teaching you, what comes with a consequence. Like, you know, you touching something in a store, like, I mean, it's just, or like wanting something in a store, they acted like the world is going in because you did that. You're like, okay.
But what they didn't realize they were doing, though, they were putting burden on you.
Yeah.
Especially for a Black girl growing up in the hood. It was almost like how you carry yourself. I always hated that foot. Watch how you carry yourself.
Oh, my God.
Because then it puts the burden of everybody else's responses on me.
Yeah. Tarana Burke dropped a word on me one time when she did my podcast, and she talked about something that every little Black girl had been told at some point, like growing up, when they tell you, like, don't sit on that man's lap. Like, you too old for that. Like, when those rules, those like kind of prepubescent rules start, and you're just trying to figure out and sort through it, like, well, what are they saying? You know what I'm saying? They're either saying something about me or saying something about him. Either way, it ain't good. You know?
Girl, let me tell you, I went to sleep. I was about, what, 11 years old, barely. 10 and a half, like 11. Went to sleep flat chested, woke up a C cup, right? So I'm still this fourth grader. I'm still this fourth grader, but I have these boobs. And for the first time in my life, but I'm still a child. I am still very much a child. But now everybody looks at you differently. And it's like men are looking at you differently. Women are looking at you like you're fast. Like, I went out and bought these things. You know what I mean? So it was such a hard place as a girl to be. And I have to say, it literally took the power of God to help me to see myself as God saw me, not as everybody. Because everybody else, I felt judgment in everybody else's eyes. Because it was all of a sudden, you were no longer a kid. You were just a sexual being now, because you had these body parts. And you never really, really felt protected. I remember even in middle school, even in high school, freshman year, my girlfriends and I walking in Southwest Philadelphia, go to the bus to go to school. And it's like, how many dudes on the corner? It was the most anxiety-filled time of our day, because it was just like you knew you weren't safe to get from one space to the next, because you have boobs and you have hips. All of a sudden, you're like, it's open season. You know what I mean? You were never insulated as a child. You know, and you said something when you were on Red Table that stuck with me. You said childhood is forever.
Yeah, my therapist said that. So credit to her.
it hit me, because I, like, our inner children live on, right? And I had to deal with that whole issue of like, okay, your body going before your mind even gets there.
You know?
So I think it's one of those burdens that parents especially put on girls. Don't be a hoe. Carry yourself. It's almost like, whoa. You know, like I went to high school with girls who were sexually assaulted, and it never went to the police because it was normalized. It was almost like a rite of passage, you know, for them. But it was always whenever they told the ones who were brave enough to tell their parents, it was like, what were you wearing? What were you doing? And so always the burden was on you, that you just carried it. It was never like, hey, let's protect you and maybe he's wrong.
Yeah. We need to learn how to build a culture of protection. And not just for women, but for all of us. And that's something I don't think we really learned growing up. It's not something necessarily that we're often socialized to do. I think there was a time where it was a big part of our culture. Like when you hear the elders talk about how, you know, it wasn't just that's Miss Johnson's daughter. It was everybody's daughter in the community.
Everybody. Right? It takes a village.
It takes a village, right? Getting back to the sort of village mentality, that it's okay for us to step in and help. It's okay for us to step in and offer advice, you know, just to create that culture of protection. I feel like a lot of it has been lost. It's tough in this country because America is built on, as somebody, I heard them recently use the term rugged individualism. You know, part of the reason why this whole COVID thing is going so badly is that, you know, we have this idea that we're invincible, and it's just like, nah, we're not. And that's part of sort of this American exceptionalism that we have built in this country. But I would like to see in our community in particular that we be able to build a culture of protection along with a culture of accountability. as well.
Oh, can we say accountability again? Because many people think accountability is attack. It's really not attack.
No.
I have a right to hold you accountable.
Yes. It's not an attack. It's a growth. Okay, because...
Because our male rappers went off this election season, boy. Oh my God.
I mean, yeah, I mean, like, I get it, because I get sometimes, and I don't want to make it seem like this is prevalent, because there's a lot of Black men who have been very supportive of me, not only in my personal life, but also just out there in the atmosphere, who have been supportive of my career and everything like that. But every now and again, I get a certain energy from Black men that is quite interesting to me, where the full toxicity comes out. And so I know where it's coming from. It's coming from a hurt place. But I hope that Black men understand, particularly when Black women bring certain issues to the table, because we have a difficult time in our community addressing misogynoir and misogyny. We have a very hard time with this, because racism, fighting institutional racism, has always been at the top of the marquee, has always been the marquee. Understand that. But underneath that, the things that are happening in our community, we have to deal with. And this is not to say that the men in our community are more prone to violence or abuse than other men in other communities, but it is to say there is a abusive culture that exists in our community that we have to address. And sometimes I need some Black men to get out their feelings and understand that any possible level of accountability that we demand or correction is not saying that all Black men are terrible or all Black men are bad or all Black men are prone to the worst instincts. Don't nobody ride for Black men like Black women. Let's just get that out there.
Nobody.
Right? Nobody. All right. Despite the fact that at times it comes at our own personal cost. And so whenever we get into those conversations where I have to critique a Black man, which I don't like to do, especially not publicly. I don't live for these moments. It's hard. It's hard for me to criticize Black people in general because I know what we go through. But at times it's necessary. And when I do it, I'll be damned if you call me a bear witch. I'll tell you what. Or their favorite, a biscuit eater, or Aunt Jemima and all that. I'm like, I need some of y'all to be less sensitive. That's what I need. So we have to be able to have a culture of accountability, because I hear so many people say, oh, well, you know, we should discuss these issues in private. Where's the meeting? We can't gather millions of Black people. Like, we can't do that. So sometimes it's going to come out in a public way. And it's not because we're trying to embarrass people, because really all I'm saying is we worried about what the white people think. Guess what? They're going to think what they think regardless. It don't matter.
Anyway.
So why do you care? Like, okay. Yes, the people that think that Black men are the biggest threat in society are going to think that regardless if I tell you not to call me a hoe. Like, it don't matter. So it doesn't matter. Like, can we get there?
I think one I would add from women to from Black women to another women I wrote down is like, you know, when we critique each other, I hear it's very popular on reality TV, or you can't keep a man. And it's like, please stop that. Nobody can. Like, it's almost like your greatest life accomplishment is you keeping a man. Why is that your job to keep? You know, it's like everything is like about a burden. Oh, it broke up. Oh, you couldn't keep a man. No, maybe because he was beating me, he had to go. You know what I mean? Maybe because he was cheating, he had to go. Maybe he had 5 kids in our 4 years together. That's why he had to go. Like, so it's like the fault is on me that, so I was supposed to just put up with that. It's like, you can't keep a man.
Yeah.
Can we not do that to one another?
Yeah. I mean, and just, you know, women as well, because I mean, we have some accountability that we have to also, you know, be open to. And certainly the way Black women at times can be with each other is a major problem. And this is, you know, part of that unlearning that you were talking about. I can't tell you the number of times that I was around older Black women who would say casually things like, well, you know, can't trust no woman around your man. Like, they just drop these seeds in there about Black women. And you're just like, oh, this your friend? Like, I mean, like, I don't, you know, that teaches us to be distrustful and skeptical of one another. And, you know, this isn't to say you should be naive about things, but it is to say that a lot of these things, that's why I said a lot of these things that we learn at the family reunion, at gatherings, or just seeing examples of this, is that these are things that we carried with us, so that we have such a high level of distrust with our own people more so than maybe other races do, where we just like, okay, you know, and we have to really be honest about where some of that skepticism and I guess self-hate kind of comes from. And it's a lot of it has been indoctrinated. It is passed down. Yeah. And we have carried, we have carried the water in many cases for white supremacy. We've carried it. And so we need to learn how to uncarry the water, because white supremacy does not need our help. It doesn't.
So how do we, though? How do we even start to unlearn that? Is it like just being... That's one thing I love about the book Cast, because it gave you so much information. It's almost like now when you walk in a minefield, it's like, okay, there's a mine over there. Like, and she's really pointing out where all the mine is so you don't step on anything and get blown up, right? So it's almost like for us now, like, how do we start to unlearn that?
I think, I'll just say, I do think a lot of us need to go to therapy. I do. I mean, you know, because there is, I don't say that casually. You know, I didn't start going to a few years ago, and it's been very eye opening. Because there, you got to be willing to do the work to kind of learn how to better yourself and learn about yourself. It's not, you know, you being raked over the coals or anything like that. But it's funny. Somebody else said this. That you spend a lot of your, they said in your 40s in particular, you spend a lot of your 40s unlearning, which is good.
Yes. Right?
You spend a lot of the time unlearning. And so.
That is so true.
It is. And I think that's why there's something that happens, some switch that's flipped, where people, they say it like, you know, at some point, you know, you just don't care anymore. It's not that you don't care. It's just that you are beginning to unlearn a lot of the baggage.
Yes.
That prevented you from let it fall off. That's what happens. And so because you get a little more secure and comfortable and experienced. So I would say a lot of us need to go to therapy, especially men, because I feel really bad for them, because there is black men in particular. There is just no, there's very few, if any, safe places for them. At least black women, we kind of have it with each other. Right. They don't always have it with one another, because they're constantly fronting for other men about their emotional security that they really don't have. And men don't allow themselves there, because I get it. They have so much pressure to be tougher, to carry themselves with this kind of bulletproof exterior. And it's like not the case. A lot of men are hurting, and they often get ridiculed when they express that hurt. That's why when celebrities, especially male celebrities, talk about, you know, certain traumas they're going through, I always think it's such a beneficial thing, because other men are watching and they'll learn that they don't have to constantly live up to these unfair expectations. So therapy is good. Self-awareness is really, really important. And we have to be willing to be honest about how we treat people and some of the learned behaviors that we have and be able to spot them. Hence why I said like therapy is really important. And it's not just about like how we treat other people. I mean, I feel like if we were kinder to ourselves in a lot of regards, that's where it starts. And
yeah.
So I always say that too, especially black women, is to be kind to yourself, be gentle with yourself, because we're carrying so much pressure and there's so many expectations for us. We often don't feel as if we have, you know, the space or the comfort and the ability to just kind of break down, right? And it's okay. You know, I've said this before and it bears repeating, is like one of the reasons, many reasons why I'm happy that I got married. And I can't say I expected to feel this way, because I was definitely on the train of like, if I get married, I do. If I don't, all right, it's fine. But one of the reasons I'm happy that I got married is because it forces me to be vulnerable in ways I am not naturally vulnerable. And that's a good thing. And so it gives me a certain safe place to be. And that's been probably, I wouldn't say challenge gives it a negative connotation. But for me, that was an issue. It's like, I did not know how to do that. You know, Carrie, my co-host, Carrie Champion, she jokes with me that I don't have a heart. She always likes to mess with me about this. And I think that's because, you know, like many black women, you're used to kind of coating yourself with a very thick armor, not just because you're
in survival mode,
because you're just trying to survive. That's it. And so most of us are, as you, I think you said this earlier in the podcast, most of us have been in survival mode to the point where we don't know how to live. And so in my 40s, I'm figuring out how to live, not just survive.
That's the word. If we had an offering plate, I would pass it around and put $5 in there and only request two back. who does that? in church. Black folks, black we get
people
change.
Definitely ask for change in the offering. Definitely. We know change. We do it, y'all. Don't try to lie.
I know I gave you 20, but I need 15 back.
Correct. Some of us would be like, we need 17 back. I swear.
I need 50 back. Because you got to buy that chicken plate. You got to buy that chicken plate at the end of the service. And it's $10.
Look, I tweet for the people who put a dollar in the offering tray. Today was like 25. I've been there. I ain't judging.
Okay, so definitely. Okay, Black History Month. What are your, you know, in closing, what are some of your Black history heroes?
Well, I think it's people who struggle. I just like deeply appreciate it and realize that if not for them, there would not be I, right? And so like Ida B. Wells, I mean, you know, we're talking about somebody who I look at as one of the mothers of journalism, exposed lynching, you know, anybody who's in our profession, you know, that's somebody that is on the Mount Rushmore of greatest journalists of all time, given what she risked. And as you said, speaking to that truth, I mean, that's one of the greatest examples of where experience and truth can meet and produce great journalism. If she were not a Black woman, she would not have known intimately about the experience of lynching and what it was doing, you know, to Black men and how it was ravaging them, and therefore would not have reported on these things at the risk of her own life. She took that experience as a Black person into that.
You know, but our journalists would have told her, be objective. It's not lynching. Men just walked up there and got on the train. You know what I mean? Right. Like, it's just like, be objective. I'm so glad she wasn't objective.
Correct.
She was a journalist.
And we need to reassess what being objective is that there is, you know, the both sides, both siderism is going to kill journalism.
What about it?
Oh,
both
my God. It's going to kill journalism because there's not an other side to wrong. Okay, there's not an other side. What is there, pro-lynching? Wait, what's the pro-lynching debate? Like, I want to hear what that is.
Or the other side to a lie. It's a lie,
right? There's no other side of that.
We had a president who was 4 years lied every day.
Oh my God, and they struggled for three of those years to call it a lie. It was like he misspoke. It was mischaracterized the truth. It's like, it's called a lie. If we lose our ability to call it a lie, then totally journalism is lost. A lot of heroines that I look up to. You brought up one, Isabel Wilkerson. She's in the present day. Not only Cass, but her other book, Warmth of Other Suns. I mean, I think those are the two best books on race that I've ever read. I mean, it's just stunning the way she's able, through examples and exhaustive research, to break down the whole deconstruction of race in this country. And I've read a lot of great books on racism, so it feels almost like I'm cheating by saying that. I've read The New Jim Crow and things by Dr. Ibram Kendi, many other things. But her two books like really registered. So I tend to look for, you know, writers who make sense of, you know, of this world, and, you know, like Nicole Hannah Jones, or even just, you know, Black journalists who are going through so many things to try to do their job, because it's an extra layer that they have to deal with, you know. So I just beam with pride when I see Yamiche Alcindor, you know, on the White House lawn. You know,
she's phenomenal.
She's unbelievable. And so I, you know, even though she's younger than me, I look up to her. I told her that, her and April Ryan. And so all these great women who have left a legacy in my profession are the people that I consider to be, you know, kind of heroes of this moment. And of course, you know, I would add in there, since we're talking about Black history, because I do think people need to be acquainted with what's currently going on. When, you know, you look at Stacey Abrams, or all the Black women who stood on the front line for democracy, who saved this nation from making a terrible mistake again. Okay,
Marvel better come out with a superhero that is Stacey Abrams. I don't want to see another movie about no damn superhero if it's not Stacey Abrams and how she saved America.
I'm telling you.
What a wonderful conversation. You know, along with Stacey Abrams, let's throw Jemele Hill in there. Maybe Jemele can be Stacey Abrams' sidekick. So Marvel, let's make that movie happen. Call me, I'll write it for you. Seriously, I really enjoyed my conversation with Jemele, because she's not just someone that I look up to. She's someone that I consider a friend. And I love her transparency. I love her boldness. And I love the fact that
she is who she is. She's not playing a role. She is as passionate as she is on social media as she is in person. So we appreciate her and all the Black women in America that went out there and voted the tyrant out of office. You guys stepped up, we stepped up. So shout out to us. You know, generally at this time, we usually do the Annie's clapback. But honestly, this episode, this entire episode was a whole clapback. So go back and listen to it again. There's so many gems. Stay tuned in the next couple of weeks. We have some really great shows for you. Just kind of, you know, looking at Raising a Pro from a Black history perspective. So much wisdom, so much insight. So tune in. As always, thank you for listening. Raising a Pro is part of the Audio Boom Originals Network. I would love it if you would subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, or share the show with someone who you know would love it or needs to hear it. See you next time, family.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.